Oi, it's 1977 Wicked Punk News, right now! And this is podcast episode 377, I meant to say, right now! Welcome back to the Punk News Podcast. This is Features Editor John Gentile. It's 70s week at Punk News. Every year we do 70s week and 90s week. We used to just do 90s week, but now that it's 1977 or 2017, we're doing 70s week too. So we're doing some special 70s stuff at Punk News. But on top of that, it was a huge week at Punk News, baby. A lot of stuff to cover this week, so I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time bullshitting around. We'll just rip through the intros. We are here with news writer, reviews writer, interviewer, Tricky Ricky Frankel. Tricky Ricky, are you you have your Zodiac medallion on? You got your perm firmed? You got your the jumpsuit ready to go?
Actually, I just changed into my bell bottom jeans. What the fuck?
Nice. And we are also here with managing editor Adam White. Adam White, you have on your leather jacket, but no shirt underneath. And the jacket's like opened up so people can see like your sweaty, hairy chest. And maybe you've got on like one of those leather caps and stuff. Is that what you got going on?
It's really fucking cold. Just you describing that seems cold to me.
It's never cold on the dance floor, Jesus. Adam. It's never cold on the dance floor.
It's cold in my Canadian basement, let me tell you. And there ain't no shirtless leather happening right now.
Well, welcome back to the Punk News Podcast. Like I said, it's 70s week. We're going to hit some mail, then we'll hit 70s week, and then we'll kick off to this proper. As always, you can reach us at podcast@punknews.org. This is from Colin, and here's what Colin has to say. Oh, this is in regards to one of our more controversial topics, the N-word, and here's what Colin has to say. It amazes me that white people can't see what happened here. Black people took a word used to denigrate, demean, and disparage them and started calling themselves it in order to take the power away from the word. Sorry if the word makes you uncomfortable, people, but it's beautiful how the black community took the word back and made it their own. From Colin, I believe that's generally the stance that Adam White and I had.
Yeah. Oh, Ricky, you missed this because you haven't been on the last couple shows, but people started writing us letters and were like, here's, you know, some of the most contentious general issues that we can come up with. Can you please address them on your podcast?
I listen to them and I'm like, I'm really glad I wasn't on these episodes. It's great. But it is good to be back. Glad I just came back in time for this letter. That's great.
Yeah. Anyways, though, I don't think anyone disagrees with that statement that the letter writer writes in. Why do we get asked that? What led into that? This is the thing about these like letters conversations is I have no idea where they originated. So funny,
like, you know, people write into them, write into us as if we're like sociology PhDs. I don't know.
Well, listen, I'm all for it because, I mean, listen, discussion and honest and open communication is what creates progress. So if people got something on their mind, I want them to feel free to write in and tell us what they're thinking.
They're encouraged. Yeah. I just can't remember at this point where that conversation came from. What got us onto that?
It didn't come from anywhere. Just somebody wrote in and said, here's what I think about the N-word. And we're like, all right. So listen, this is from Jeff. This is a fun one. Jeff says, hi, my name's Jeff. I have compiled a list of artists that some chums and I love to discuss on whether or not said artists are overrated in a musical sense. Skipping over any cultural impact and focusing solely on the music, please review the list with your Punk News comrades and let the world know if you think any of these artists are overrated. So here we go. I guess we'll start with Adam, go to Ricky, and we'll wind up with me. Adam, first to you. Elvis.
We're asking, is Elvis overrated?
Musically, is he overrated or underrated? Or rated right?
Okay, like musically over... culturally probably about on point, but you can't have the Elvis discussion without talking about like all the black artists that Elvis appropriated from.
I disagree with that entirely, Adam. I disagree with that stance entirely.
I'm not saying Elvis has no worth. I'm saying you can't discuss him in a vacuum without discussing all of this contextual stuff that led into him. And a discussion of Elvis should logically lead you down to check out all of these other artists that in a lot of cases were recording like the better, more hoppin' version of the songs that he would play. Same with everyone from
I disagree with that, but I agree that if you check out Elvis, you should check out Sister Rosetta Thorpe, Big Mama Thornton, and all those artists. However, you use the word appropriation, which is such a loaded word these days. I don't think you can say Elvis appropriated those groups.
I did not mean appropriation necessarily in the modern contextualization of that word. I'm thinking appropriation more in that like
utilization.
Let's just talk about like influence.
Yeah,
let's just use like the generic old influence is what I meant.
Because Elvis made it a point to bring those artists like on stage and on TV shows with him, and he was frustrated.
I wasn't passing a judgment that like he did something he shouldn't have. I'm just more saying that like to talk about it like Elvis woke up one day, opened his cupboard, found all these like got some flour and some sugar and then mixed up like a fucking batch of rock and roll is a little bit disingenuous. That's all.
Fair enough.
That's how you make rock and roll, by the way.
I don't think he's overrated. Culturally, I think he's probably I think he's on
the question is just music, not cultural impact.
I don't think he's
however
overrated.
I will say Elvis is underrated. I think especially in the modern era post 1985 or whatever 1980, if you listen to both the early Elvis records, they're so punk. I mean, Elvis is not punk, but they're punk sounding in it that there's like four instruments, bass, drum, guitar, and Elvis just gone, you ain't nothing but a hound dog. And then you listen to like the live records from later on, live at Madison Square Garden, the rhythm and blues record, which is an amazing, amazing record. Songs like In the Ghetto, songs like Crying in the Rain, just his big, beautiful, amazing voice. No one sings with Elvis with the power and the tenderness and the range. Elvis underrated. Adam White, next one to you. The Beatles.
I would definitely not say under. The universe has sort of decided that the Beatles were this magical thing, and I would agree. I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree too. I mean, they just did so much in the 10 years that they were together, and they have influenced countless bands. Like, I'm not like exaggerating. They've literally like a ton of bands always talk about how they were influenced by the Beatles, regardless of genre. So, I think they are just about where they need to be. I don't think they're overrated.
And they only had one. One goofy ska song, so that shows some history.
The Beatles are rated extremely high, so I would say they are slightly overrated. And I don't mean that to denigrate the Beatles. I think the Beatles are an amazing, amazing group and one of the greatest groups of all time. Not the greatest group of all time. However, I think people tend to overlook a lot of the crap the Beatles had. Listen, Sgt. Pepper is a great album, but it's got lots of filler on it. For the Benefit of Mr. Kite, even She's Leaving Home, they're boring.
A side of the White Album that doesn't need to be there. I'll grant you that.
I see the White Album is my favorite album. I love the White Album, but
really,
I love the White Album.
Like that's when they brought Yoko in there, and you just like she does that. Like, was it Revolution Number 9? That was so stupid.
Oh, I love that though because like all the songs in the album are basically traditional-ish songs, except for Happiness is a Warm Gun and those kind of tracks. But then at the end of side four, and it's such a long album, there's just this weird freak out. I dig it. But my argument with the Beatles is, yes, they're very influential, but I mean, who do they really influence? Like the Flaming Lips, Belle and Sebastian? I take that back. They influence a lot of people. I take that all back. They influence like bands like Motorhead and stuff. That being said, I think they're slightly overrated. A lot of junk in the discography, a lot of great stuff. Rolling Stones are better. Next one, Adam White, Nirvana.
I'm a latter-day Nirvana convert in that when I was young, I was just about the age where I was like sort of getting into music when Kurt died. So I didn't interact with Nirvana too much prior to his death, but I knew a lot of people that I hated in elementary school that were like wearing those like giant 90s t-shirts that went all the way down to your knees where it was just like a full print of Kurt's head on it. And I hated all those guys. So I ignored Nirvana forcefully for a long time. And just like super recently, I decided it was something I actually had to go back and revisit. So, I mean, like the Beatles, I'm pretty sure that like the culture has already taken and decided that this is something that we need to pay attention to. I think that Nirvana, when they're being loud and abrasive, is way more interesting than Nirvana playing like a sappy MTV acoustic set. I think maybe that's a little bit overrated, but hey.
Overrated. I've tried so many times to get into this band. I've tried like I think 3 or 4 times, and it just I just can't get into it. I think contextually, I mean, back then I get why people were into it, but I just couldn't get into it. I couldn't find my way around that discography at all. And I think there's like one song I like. Everything else just didn't do anything for me. I don't hate it. I do think they're overrated though.
A mulatto, an albino, a mosquito, my libido. Yay, hey, yay. Agree with Ricky, overrated. Next group, Beach Boys.
Yeah, but you hear Patti Smith play that song and it's fucking harsh. Anyways.
Well, listen, Patti Smith is next level. Adam White, Beach Boys.
I had a music teacher in university that sort of like sat us down and played, you know, took a song, like say like Sloop Jong B and completely disassembled it into all the parts and to all the, like the time signature changes and all the instrumentation changes and all the things that were going on in there. So I definitely appreciate that, but I could never get into them as like, to me, they were always like a cheesy band that was on the oldies station. And I grew up with so much of just hearing, you know, the most vapid Beach Boys, you know, love song thingies, that by the time it was introduced to me that, you know, like, oh no, there was like some crazy fucking genius going on in here. I'd be sitting like in an academic setting and say, all right, I absolutely understand that. But I would never go home and be like, all right, I got to go rock some Beach Boys now and figure out the rest of this. I just couldn't get around that. So I'm going to say over. The universe loves the Beach Boys. I think the universe might love certain songs and a certain musical genius that was in that band. But when you add it all up, I don't know. Over.
I'd actually say slightly under. I mean, I would say, no, I'm sorry. I would say they're not overrated or underrated, but they're leaning towards underrated. It wasn't until fairly recently that Pet Sounds was finally appreciated for what it was. And because it got panned, I believe, or it didn't sell when it first came out. I actually had in high school, I had a music appreciation teacher talk about, do a whole thing on them. And apparently Paul McCartney at one point told him that God Only Knows is the best pop song of all time. I think that has to say something. So I think they're just about where they need to be. Again, a lot of they've also influenced a ton of people, a ton of bands. So I think they're right where they need to be. But maybe for a long time, we're kind of underrated.
We all know the best pop song. Oh, go ahead, Adam.
I don't know, I totally agree with I think all of our music teachers like got the same curriculum, because like I got the same Pet Sounds stuff, and I don't disagree with any of it, but at the same point, like all I can think of is hearing like Good Vibrations 700 times on like an AM radio station, and I'm just I can't do it.
Yeah, there's no doubt that their quote unquote hits are overplayed, but I think if you were to delve deep into their discography a little bit, I think they'd come out just about like they're at where they need to be. I don't think they're overrated.
We all know
this is the perfect letter, John, to open up our holy shit. There's a lot of news. We really got to get to it week, but keep
seriously.
Going.
We all know that the best pop song is Who Can It Be Now by Men at Work. For the Beach Boys. Listen, I love the early singles. Like their albums are actually like, got a lot of filler on them, but like the early singles collections, like their greatest hits is great. Pet Sounds, amazing, amazing, amazing album. Incredible skill, incredible Miracle content, which actually was not written by the Beach Boys. That wasn't written by Van Dyke Parks. Ricky, you might know that. Wasn't Pet Sounds lyrics written by Van Dyke Parks, or was that written by the Beach Boys?
I don't know.
Yeah, we'll look into that, folks. Amazing record, incredible production, incredible sonic vision, incredible sense of melancholy, which we hadn't really heard that much in that kind of music before. That being said, beyond 20 Kraken singles and Pet Sounds, what else do the Beach Boys really have? I think maybe that record is a little overrated, and the Beach Boys might be they're an incredible group, and I'm not saying they're bad. They're an amazing group, but are they really as incredible as everyone says they are? I'm willing to say they're overrated, but I'm open to discussion on this at a later date. We've got other mail. We'll get to that next week because we've got a lot to cover today, so we're going to close this one out. So if you send us mail, we didn't lose it. We're going to get to it. You can always reach us at podcast@punknews.org. But this leads us to our discussion, fifth and final on Jeff's list, Adam White, the Ramones, overrated or underrated?
Under. Yeah, under. Under because, and John, we've talked about this before, the world sort of decided that, okay, you know, the Ramones were super, super groundbreaking with the amount of minimalism that they brought into everything and the amount of bands that they influenced. And then but at the same point, like the world went, but you know, all these songs kind of sound the same. So once we get past, once we get past like End of the Century and our little Phil Spector experimentation, we're good, we're done. And the Ramones just kept Ramones and released like 45 more records after that, and everyone just sort of ignores them. But you and I have talked a little bit about the latter day Ramones and why people might want to give more of a shit than they do. So under.
Yeah, I'd say under too. I think, I mean, for us in our, you know, punk news sphere, I think they're probably where they need to be. But overall, I think they are not appreciated in the mainstream as much as they should be. So I'm going to stick with under.
I'm going to say underrated both in the mainstream world and the punk rock world. First of all, you can't overstate the Ramones' importance. Pretty much every punk band, including the Clash and Sex Pistols, were influenced by the Ramones. But not only that, is the music is just so good. It's so, I mean, I would say the first five records are completely bulletproof, but everyone has to be. The first three records are completely bulletproof. It's just great song after great sound, unique sound that no one had heard before, unique lyrics, unique angles. Like, no one wrote lyrics like Dee Dee and even Johnny and Joey before the Ramones came around. You know, like songs like Commando, songs like Carbone and Occlu, songs like
53rd.
Great example, Ricky. Great example. That's the ideal example. So that being said, I'm going to say underrated because the Ramones are amazing. And I'm not just saying that to be Mr. Punk Rock. The Ramones, like every time I put them on, it's like, wow, this is so good. And that brings us to our, well, it's 70s week at Punk News. Let's talk about this first. Then we'll talk about 70s week. We can go through this kind of quickly if we want. The Ramones are re-releasing a mega deluxe edition of Rocket to Russia, which of course is their third album, and what some people say is the last of the classic original lineup with Johnny, Joey, Marky, and Dee Dee. Johnny, Joey, Dee Dee, and Tommy. The Mega Deluxe Edition is going to, like the previous two Mega Deluxe Editions, it's going to have two mixes of the album, the original mix and a new modified mix. It's going to have some demos and also a live recording from Glasgow, Scotland from December 19, 1977, which has not been released yet. But I believe that the setlist will be almost identical to It's Alive because it's from the same time period. And another live album got released from that time period, and it's the same exact setlist from It's Alive. So a couple of questions here. Is it time to reevaluate Rocket to Russia? Should people buy this? Is this worth buying? Or is this just, you know, more of the same and we already have everything we need from the 2002 remasters, which were amazingly done?
I mean, I wouldn't get this just because... I mean, isn't this all CDs?
Good question. The first one had a CD and had CDs and a record. I don't know if this has CDs yeah. and a record.
I see. I'm looking at the Rolling Stone thing, and it looks like it's just three CDs. You know, I don't need this. I think I have a reissue on 180 gram that I'm very happy with. And I actually have Live at the Roxy, which I'm very happy with too. So this, although I love this record and reviewed it for 70s week, I will pass.
Yeah. I'm never sure about buying these big super collector sets at this point in my life. Not because they don't look wonderful, but I keep falling back on the CD thing where I'm like, I'm not in a place where I'm sitting around listening to CDs. The only place I have a CD player is in my car. And if you have content like this, where it's a bunch of like semi-obscure archival stuff and live stuff that they've pulled together, that's not the thing that I want to listen to in like the 9 minutes that I'm going to be in my car to go anywhere. So I don't really have a place for it. It's almost like that. Remember that big cool Clash box set that came out that had like a giant fucking cigarette with it?
Yeah. Sound system. Right?
The one that was like the boombox shaped thing. I looked at pictures of that and I was like, oh, that looks really cool. But then I'm like, oh, wait, it's a bunch of fun stuff. And then a bunch of CDs that I already own. I just don't need I don't need to acquire more CDs. If these things were records, and I hate to be that guy, if they were records, I might be a little bit more interested in it because it fits more.
You are being that guy, Adam. I got to say,
I am being that guy. But when I'm going to go and sit down in a room and just like nerd out about some music stuff, that is a record player in my life right now. The computer is for when at work and there's people talking to me and I'm listening to the phone ring. CDs, I guess, are for my car, although that doesn't actually play out in practice. And just, yeah. So these big crazy CD box sets, 1990 something Adam would be totally stoked. Early 2000s Adam would be totally stoked. Right now, I don't know.
Well, listen, I don't understand these guys hang up on format. To me, format is almost meaningless, to tell you the truth, as exemplified by my thriving record label. That being said, is I would like to check this out. The only thing I find, though, with these massive deluxe box sets where it's a lot of the same version of the same stuff, then you really only end up like listening to it like once or twice and you just retreat to the main thing. Because let's be honest, the best thing on this is the original album. The live release was something super unique, I would be more interested to get it. But it's basically just another recording of the set list from It's Alive. So it's not going to blow your mind because the Ramones were famously consistent live, and that like pretty much every live show, you know, from that same era sounded exactly the same. Same set list, same speed. So if it was like $25, I would pick it up. $60, I don't think I need it. It's cool. Maybe 10 years from now, I'll see it on the discount rack and I'll pick it up. But it looks cool, but I don't think I need it. That being said, I am glad that Linda Ramone and Mickey Lay, Linda Ramone is the wife of Johnny Ramone and Mickey Lay is the brother of Joey Ramone. I think you guys will agree that they're doing a good job in maintaining respect and reverence for the catalog. And they're not just kind of like pipping it out and like making trash out of it. Do you guys agree?
Oh, I mean, absolutely. I went to the Johnny Ramone thing. What was it? Johnny Ramone event at the where he's buried in at the Hollywood Forever Cemetery last year. It was great. And then I gotta tell you, on Record Store Day this year, I got that Ramones singles box set that I'm really liking too. So they're doing fine. You can tell like they're doing a fine job. They're not like exploiting it, I think they're doing it just right.
Well, they have it. Ricky's about to play Ramone soon, but before we get to that, yeah. It's 70s week. Well, actually, go ahead, Ricky, play a tune, and then we'll come back and we'll mention that.
Oh, okay. I reviewed for 70s week, I did Nevermind the Bollocks by the Sex Pistols, but I also did Rocket to Russia by the Ramones, so I felt like it was appropriate to do something off that album. So here is the classic Sheena is a Punk Rocker by the Ramones off Rocket to Russia.
Yeah. down and got their surfers and they're going to the discotheque and go-go. But she just couldn't stay. She had to break away. But New York City really has it all. Oh yeah, oh yeah. She is a phone rocker. She is a phone rocker. She is a phone rocker now.
And that was Sheena is a punk rocker by the Ramones. What's the story? Was that like, what was the one that was supposed to be on the second album and they put Sheena is a punk rocker on it? Or was that Carbona Not Glue? There was a track that were
Carbona Not Glue was actually for, I don't know the exact reason, but the higher ups, I think found it inappropriate, and it actually was taken off
Leave Home originally. I know that
Leave Home, and it wasn't put back on. I actually have a promo copy of Leave Home on vinyl, and it does have Carbona Not Glue
cool.
on it.
That's cool.
I don't think it ever really made it back on. I don't know. I guess that song about huffing glue. Is that why they took
Carbona
it off?
Not Glue is yeah.
Yeah, so Sheena Punk is a punk rocker. I do not know if it was supposed to be on that or not. I think it fits better on Rocket to Russia.
Here we go. The Carbona Not Glue was replaced with Sheena is a punk rocker in the United States on Leave Home.
Wow. I did not know that.
Wow. So anyways, it's 70s week of punk news. The readers love 90s week. I love 70s week. And during 70s week, we basically just run reviews of albums from minus 40 years in the current time. So this, of course, is 1977, which I guess you could say is the golden age of punk rock. And I don't think you can say it's the beginning of punk rock because Sex Pistols and Ramones were around in 75, first Ramones album in 76. But it's really, I guess, the era of the punk boom was 1977.
1977 right. has always been to me the most important year. Like that, it's the year everything broke. It's the year so many bands that everyone... Everyone references as classic punk bands outside of the sort of like the original that's there. They all formed. So like everyone formed at that point, like Black Flag was getting together, right? Bad Brains was getting together. You know, everyone else came together. That was it. So 77 has always been like this magical number that has been like in my head, like a numerology thing. Like it is a magic number. Whenever I encounter it, there's a part of my brain that's like, oh yeah, 77, that's the year punk broke. And I don't know, it's always been very special, and it's always been something that like at a really early age, and it was driven into my head, and it was probably driven into my head by the Clash song of that name. But there were so many things when I was just like a fledgling little teenage kids starting to get into punk music and reading into all this history that just time and time again just banged on 77, 77, 77. So it is one of the most important numbers in my life, Mr. John Gentile. It's a big one here. Here's the Wikipedia list, at least, of who formed that year, right? So the Avengers, Bad Brains, Black Flag, Crass, Discharge, Fear, the Flesh Eaters, the Germs, Misfits, 999, the Pagans, the Plasmatics, VOM, the Weirdos, X, and X-Ray Specs. So that's just who formed.
Crazy.
And then like records, like as far as things that were released, right? The first Clash record, you had Damn Damn Damned, Dead Boys, Young, Loud, and Snotty. I think like the only Johnny Thunders and the Heartbreakers record, at least the one that anyone cares about. The Jams in the City, Rocket to Russia, of course, Blank Generation by Richard Hell, Sex Pistols we talked about, Marquee Moon by Television, Pink Flag by Wire. It's like all this shit. And then all this stuff that was fledgling new wave, but was still sort of punk rock related and still pretty punky by today's standards. So, like My Name is True by Elvis Costello, Suicide, the first Talking Heads record, all that shit came out. So 77 was important.
You look at the records that came out, like the time frame is insane. It's like a groundbreaking record is coming out like every 2 weeks. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And it's one of those things that if you fantasize like about like, man, if I could like go back in time and just live a year and get to go to record stores and buy originals of things, fucking 77 would be it for me. Like that is the year. Cause just like everything came out, like all this classic shit. There's classic stuff that was like, just even from the rest of the world that like Iggy Pop's Lust for Life was out that year. Like, everything.
Oh, so. God, the Jams in the City came out. When I 10th grade, that was my shit.
Listen, if you went to these gigs where it was like Ramones and Sex Pistols, I mean, not Ramones, Sex Pistols and Clash, or like Ramones and Television, or, you know, Iggy Pop and Dead Boys, do you think those gigs really would be like the craziest, greatest thing ever? Or do you think it's just been amplified and it would just be a pretty good gig, you know? The question,
I don't know. I have sitting on top of my record player right now. I have a little framed reproduction print of the flyer for the Screen on the Green show, which was Sex Pistols, The Clash, and The Buzzcocks on Sunday, August 29th, 1977. Refreshments available. Tickets are £1. So. Jeez.
I
That whole poster is written in Sharpie too. It's super budget. It's great.
Do you think the greatest gig you saw this year would be as good as the greatest gig you would have seen in 1977 if you were, say, 24?
I wonder, I think we're fighting now.
What go ahead, Adam.
You want to do it? You talk. I think
it depends on what band from back then. Like I think just from what I've seen online, like a Sex Pistols show looked like a lot of fun, assuming it didn't get shut down or anything. But I think maybe we romanticize this period a little bit in terms of the live stuff. I mean, clearly the studio stuff speaks for itself, no doubt. But I can't imagine. I mean, these bands weren't perfect. They probably had shitty shows too. So, but I think they were probably really good. Like those jam shows that you can see, they looked like a lot of fun. Ramon shows looked like a lot of fun, especially when after they kind of got some momentum going behind them. So, I think overall they'd be good.
I mean, on a purely sure. like superficial fashion level. That era of punk rock to me is where punk rock looked its most interesting, where you had, especially in the UK, the New York thing was cool because they had this, but they were appropriating a lot of this like greaser look into it. But in the UK, nothing had been codified as far as, you know, oh, punk rock is, you know, leather and spikes and mohawks or anything like that. Like that's all 82 stuff. Like this was still punk is just like thrift store pile on of whatever. And you could have people showing up to the show wearing like a fucking garbage bag or something that they found. Yeah. and the mix that you had in the crowd was not like punk rock as this like uniform cliche that came about in the bands that came that were influenced by the 77 era. It was all still I want to use creative, but I don't know if that's the right word for it, but like it was still fluid, right? Like it had not yet solidified on anything, so there was a lot of opportunity to go out and to just be like you know, truly weird and fucked up. And it's funny because you look at some of the crowds in some of these old shows, and there's totally people that are at these early Clash and Sex Pistols shows that are in the crowds there that aren't, they don't look anything because this was all still so new. So you had people there that looked like, you know, they just showed up out of school, and they're wearing all their, you know, proper normal person clothes. And then two people over, there's, you know, again, there's someone wearing garbage, and that element where there was still a lot of possibility, and that we hadn't yet decided that, like, oh, this is what punk rock is, and this is what it looks like, and this is how you're supposed to look. That's kind of amazing to me. So, like, I would have liked to have seen that. Even, and I totally agree with Ricky. A lot of these performances were probably fucking horrible, but you know,
I don't know if that's true. I mean, like I'll use Bad Canoes as an example. You know, one of my favorite bands ever. I saw Bad Canoes 14 times, 12 times. Never a bad performance. I saw Classics of Love. I saw every single Bay Area Classics of Love show. Never a bad performance. I think so. Maybe they never did have, like, maybe the Ramones never had a bad gig. I think what's understated too, and you know, everyone's like, oh man, punk was so great, punk was so good. One of the reasons punk was so great is because nobody knew about it, and so you really had to have a certain vision to be a part of it. Like, people, I think, forget how small the punk community was in 1976, 1977. I love videos with, like, Billy Idol or you know, with Jello Biafra or whatever, where they're, like, looking at, like they're holding up a picture of the crowd, and he's like, oh yeah, that's Steve Smithers, you know, and that's Wendy Jones. Like, they can name every single person in the crowd because that's how small the community was, you know, and how artistically inclined they all were.
Yeah, there's that one famous picture that always gets me from that era, and I forget exact. I don't know if it was from 77 or when it was from exactly, but it's like it's a bunch of women that were in that scene, and it's, here it is. It's like Chrissy Hynde, Debbie Harry, Viv Albertine, Polly Styrene, Susie Sue, and Pauline Black, and they're all just hanging out, like all these people that went on to front all of these, you know, fucking influential bands, and they're all just, like, you know, they're just kind of like in a crowd together.
Well, I think the other thing is, you know, for us, punk's been around for decades, but this was such a turnaround from the, you know, the bullshit hippie era of, you know, flowers and other shit like that, that I think this, it probably would have been like quadruply as fascinating for us back then. So I think that might just be part of it.
I'd be interested to know, and I agree with you, Ricky. I do think punk was a cultural zeitgeist, if you will. But was it, like, you know, because, like, Hawkwind had existed, the Electric Eagles had existed, Dictators had existed, New York Dolls. So was punk really this brand new explosion, or was that after the fact recreation, and that really punk was just, you know, part of a continuous stream of a certain mindset? I think
it just sort of solidified in 77.
Yeah, the big difference to me is that, like, despite all the fact that you had all of these weird and wonderful bands that were out there, they weren't necessarily inspiring people to go pick it up. Right? So, like, you know, you had your Hawkwinds, John, but Hawkwind wasn't telling, like, a generation of kids, you know, go buy a guitar and be a Hawkwind, right? But to, like, the Ramones, you could see the Ramones, and they were like, you know, so many people saw that band and were like, fuck, I'm getting a guitar, right? Like, I think that it's that, right? It's they were able to take this, take this sort of, like, aggressive weirdness and then be like, you could do it too, and get people into it. And I think that's the big deal. And holy fuck, we are 40 minutes into this show. Well, we haven't touched on either of the gigantic ass stories this week.
Well, let's get to it. But I do have to mention one last thing, and then we'll get to it. As Adam was talking about favorite pictures from, like, the 77, 78 era, my favorite picture from that era is the Black Flag picture at Pollywog Park, where you have Keith Morris and Chuck Dukowski ducking sandwiches, and on the ground are two guys fighting for a sandwich on the ground. And of course, those two guys are Ron Reyes and Des Escondida, who would become the second and third singer of Black Flag. So I love those pictures. Anyways, we had a lot of fun, boys. We were all laughing it up. Well, listen, we got to pull the plug on the fun. Brand New, a band that means a whole lot to a lot of punkers, but I think nothing to we three, because we have taste. Brand New's singer, Jesse Lacey, has been accused of sexual misconduct with at least two people who were minors at the time of the misconduct. Basically, the accusations are essentially very similar or the same. Lacey would talk to young fans on the internet and would ask them for nude pictures. One girl was 15 and one girl was 16 when he got nude pictures from them and allegedly sent them nude pictures as well. Lacey then admitted to doing that. Basically, he said, I did it. He apologized. He said, the actions of my past have caused pain and harm to a number of people, and I want to say I am absolutely sorry. I do not stand in defense of myself, nor do I forgive myself. I was selfish, narcissistic, and insensitive in my past, and there are a number of people who have had to shoulder the burden of my failures. You can read his whole statement at Punk News. It's very long. A lot of people really weren't thrilled with his statement. He was criticized for really not apologizing to the victims themselves and focusing more on his infidelity than, I guess, trying to hook up with minors or getting nude pictures from minors. This is particularly striking, I guess, because Brand New is a pop punk band, but pop punk in the 2000 sense, not in the Ramones Screeching Weasel sense. And this band, I think a lot of people identify with their lyrics, and a lot of their lyrics deal with like relationships, which, you know, I kind of can't stand that kind of stuff because I just want to destroy the world. So anyway, this came as quite the shocker to a lot of people, and it follows in the wake of, I guess you would say the wave of, I guess, outings or accusations following Harvey Weinstein being the world's biggest creep. So people are shocked.
People love this band. I mean, and this is just as right off a rekindling of that love. People had been like fervently into this band since Déjà Entendu, which was their, I don't know if that was their first record or just the one that was their big break record, came out probably, God, what would it have been, 2002, 2003 or something like that when it would have come out. But in any case, like people were incredibly into this band, and this was the, like the figurehead band, one of the figurehead bands for this. I'm never sure what to call the genre because it's so fraught, but let's just say emo, right? For this like modern day post 2000 emo thing that grew out of the pop punk era. And But the love was all just rekindled because earlier this year the band released a surprise LP that no one knew that they had in the can, and they just did a big they just wrapped up a big tour that everyone, I mean, shit, we ran pictures from the tour. Like it was a big deal that that they were out and about and back in the world and had a new record. And there's a part of me that is selfishly relieved that this is not one of my bands.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
like, and I hate to say this because I don't want to minimize like the harm that this guy did to anyone, but from a purely selfish standpoint, when this broke, my immediate thing was just like, oh, good. It's not one of the, thank God this isn't a band I give a shit about. Like, I don't want to, like this is gross and horrible, and I'm so glad I don't like this band because it's gonna make, you know, processing that a lot easier for me. At the same point, this band meant so much to so many people. I mean, if you want to speak nicely, by the way, about our co-patriots over at, say, like the Absolute Punk Universe, that website's not exist anymore, it's a new site now.
Course FM,
right? Yeah. Right, yeah. So, I mean, to speak no ill of them, but they were always into stuff that was more modern and new than sort of like the punk news world was. And Brand New for them was like, it was on the pantheon. Like, they treated Brand New like we've talked about the Clash. Like, to a certain segment, this band is big. And oh, that's gotta, as a fan, that's gotta really fuck with you to have to go contend with this, right? So, yeah.
Yeah,
I feel for that. I mean, yeah, that jump in, Rick.
You know, I tried listening to the new record. I didn't fucking get it. I don't know why they were so big to begin with. I mean, I follow some people like on Twitter and YouTube and stuff, and they're like mainstream music reviewers and podcasters and whatever. They're not in like our realm at all, but they love this.
Oh,
thing.
I mean, you remember Mr. Pitchfork?
No. There, it's a small. I'm thinking specifically of one small YouTube channel that I really enjoy. I tried to get to listen to this. I didn't get it. What happens to a band? Is this guy the lead singer or what's the deal?
He's basically Mr. Brand New.
How does a band survive this? I mean he's not denying, he didn't deny anything. That's
he admitted to it.
Yeah, so how do you, I'd be surprised if this band stays together much longer. I mean, if they cancel all they canceled all the tours, all this stuff, what do you do? And also the other thing I was going to say was I remember it was a Deja on Tondu, whatever the fuck it's called. That was like one of the big record store day items.
It was
a year or two ago. They did like a it's the one with the astronaut on it, right? That one like was a huge. That was like a big like thing for. That was like the number one thing for. Maybe it was record store day 2015. I mean, and it went fast, like really fast, and it just showed how crazy people are for this band. I didn't get it. This doesn't look good, to put it lightly for them. So again, I wouldn't be surprised if, I mean, what does he do? Does he go to rehab, quote unquote rehab, and then come back and say, I'm all better. And then they continue, or does this just end the band? I'm curious to see how they, if they are going to spin it, how they will spin it, if they're going
to
continue.
I think my take on your question is, on how a band can recover from something like this depends on the type of band it is. When you have a band here that operates generally in the, I don't know, teenage or to early 20 audience, and they're generally, I guess you would say, emotional bands and bands that are not mean guys, they present themselves as nice guys, no coming back from that. That's the end of the band. Whereas if it was like Motley Crue or whatever, then their fans wouldn't give a shit. Then they could just roll over that. It wouldn't be a problem, you know?
But he sent photos of himself.
That's
to
what
them?
I'm saying. There's no coming back from this. I'm interested in the psychology. Listen, this guy's creepy. I'm interested in the psychology of this, in that this guy could have, and we've had this discussion before, this guy could have any girl he wanted overage, you know? So why is he doing that? The only answer you can come to is, well, maybe he's into the illegal aspect. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't seem to be a situation where he hooks up with a girl, turns out she was 17. It seems to be is a situation where he's looking for young girls, which means, is this a scenario we've seen multiple times before where creep gets famous and does creepy stuff as opposed to guy gets famous and makes a few bad decisions.
I would like to add one thing to that, because just out of the whole like Hollywood on fire thing that's been happening the last few weeks. I think it also has to do with just someone being adored for a long time, a long periods of time, and having just a certain amount of power and adoration them all the time. And I think that makes them at some point kind of think that they could probably get away with anything they wanted to when they can't.
I hear that. I'd love to get a psychologist read on this, because just because you can do something doesn't mean you want to do something. For example, I could go spend all my money on, I don't know, jelly, but I don't want to. You know what I mean? So
It might just be that
he was famous enough.
I don't know. It could be just the taboo.
He was famous that he could have sex with underage girls, but why would he want to? Like, when there's lots of good looking of age girls. So that implies that he's a creep. So I'd be very interested in the psychology of this.
Did he know that they were 15? Do we know that?
Listen, if a girl's 15,
or whatever.
I mean,
Still, I mean, it doesn't make a difference, but I mean,
you know,
like,
what I'm saying, like, you know, still, she ain't 22, you know what I mean? So,
oh, exactly. Yeah. So, yeah. So no, this is weird. And this isn't good.
One last thing I want to point out is there's so many bands that people say, oh, this band's horrible because they have these kind of lyrics. This band's horrible because they have this on their album cover. In my experience, those bands are actually the okay people, and the bands that are on the soapbox or the bands that are presenting themselves as nice guys are the real creeps. And it makes sense because they're trying to present themselves as non-creeps so they can do creepy things, whereas the other edgy bands, we'll just use Gwar as an example. You know, Gwar can be, you know, creepy or weird in their music because they're not actually creepy people, so they're not scared to exhibit that side because that's not really them. And so I think the punk community as a whole could do a better job of reassessing a band's lyrical content and how they express themselves to who they are as actual people. Punk has a long-standing trait of going by what someone says, not what they do, when really it should be the opposite. We should judge a person on what they do, not what they say. Speaking of a guy that we judge on both what he does and what he says, and he says a lot, it's Morrissey Day in L.A. November 10 was Morrissey Day in L.A. It was declared Morrissey Day by City Councilwoman Monica Rodriguez, and she said, Morrissey Day honors the man who put the M in Los Angeles, an icon whose music continues to touch and uplift countless people across the globe. Morrissey uses his voice to raise awareness for many social issues while, in his own strange way, always staying true to his fans. And even the mayor went in on this action. Here's what Mayor Eric Garcetti said. Los Angeles embraces individuality, compassion, and creativity, and Morrissey embraces those values in a way that moves Angelinos of all age. Morrissey's Day celebrates an artist whose music has captivated and inspired generations of people who may not always fit in because they were born to stand out. Which people thought that last note read a little sour. The question,
he's the worst.
The question, listen, I'm glad Morrissey's getting respect. The question is, does this really mean anything? But also, should a city be using its time and resources to declare days for artists?
No.
I'll let Adam go first on this one because no. I live in this stupid city.
Yeah. I want the genuine LA reaction for Ricky in a sec. But in abstract, I've never understood why cities declare this or that days or what it actually means. And I think that, like, as an adult, I know what it means is that to blow off some steam, they've decided that they're going to sign this piece of paper that they've been petitioned by some wacko that's come to the council meeting and has requested this, and that there is no tangible anything that happens for it. Like, to declare it Morrissey Day means shit. Well, everyone's still going to work. Nothing is happening. There's no parade. There's nothing. When I was a kid, I would imagine that
Rome,
something,
you know, Adam. That goes back to ancient Rome declaring days after people.
Well, we all know what happened to ancient Rome, right? but as a child, I would have had imagined that if it is declared like John Gentile Day in the city of Baltimore, then, you know, the mayor of Baltimore would give you a giant fucking golden key. And that key, John, would open any door in town, because that's the way that I imagine things work when you get the key to the city. And then there's a parade with streamers. Like, you'd basically get the parade that, like, they gave to, like, Neil Armstrong when and Buzz Aldrin and all them. So you would get this parade where, like, there's confetti and streamers and things like that. And at some point you're on a podium that's covered in those, like, squiggly red, white, and blue, you know, semicircle things. Do those have a name? Americans? You know what I mean?
Podiums with the American flag?
No, that there's those, like, those red, white, and blue, I don't know, decorations that you guys have that you
I don't know if
they're
got a name.
Flags. They're like a...
Wait, wreaths?
No, he means just like those half circle flags that you see in like the houses.
Well, it's all like crinkly paper and yeah.
Oh,
I don't.
Those
know
don't have a name.
About.
Anyways, I'm gonna find this out instead of listening to whatever you guys talk about for the rest of the podcast. Anyways, though, that's what I imagined happened when it was like fucking John Gentile Day in Baltimore. But that's not the way it works. It's just bullshit. And every time I see that it's someone's day, it just further proves to me that the universe is way less whimsical than I want it to be, and I hate it. Ricky.
Wait, so Adam, you're mad because it's Morrissey Day, but the city's not doing enough to cherish Morrissey? Is that what it is?
I don't understand in any which way, shape, or form why it would be Morrissey Day in LA of any city, but and I don't really know if Morrissey deserves a day, but that said, the fact that anyone gets a day, I'm suspect.
Okay,
do it.
This was so insignificant that I didn't even know about this until I saw the story on Punk News. So this was not a big deal at all. Why our local government is doing this and not fixing the, I mean, aside from Hollywood just collapsing on itself, which, you know, that's happening. We have Los Angeles has a ton of problems. This doesn't seem like a good use of resources. And since Garcetti's gotten in, he hasn't been doing much. All he's really done is this stupid shit. And then get us the Olympics in 2024, which I've been against forever. And this wasn't a thing. I know. Now, here's the thing. Morrissey is gigantic out here. He really I've had friends and a girlfriend of mine was a huge Morrissey fan.
Is that why you hate Morrissey so much?
No. I don't like Morrissey just because of just the character of Morrissey. I don't really care about his music that much. So yeah, this was totally insignificant. It was kind of dumb. I didn't notice anything. If there was supposed to be a parade, it didn't happen. We have bigger problems out here. This is not one of the things we should be doing. And cancel the Olympics, please. God.
Well, listen, more and more with Donald Trump in office, the government, both federal and many state governments, are trying to crush the arts. So I'm all for cities, states, nations celebrating the arts and preserving the artists and giving due props to people that enlighten our lives and gives a deeper view and understanding of ourselves. And boy, did they pick a great and wonderful and talented musician to celebrate Morrissey Day on November 10. Kudos to you, LA, for celebrating a unique, sometimes troubling, sometimes difficult man. But what great art isn't troubling and difficult at certain times? Kudos to you, LA, for picking someone that rankles some people the wrong way, but Dallasly has accomplished great things, as opposed to someone that everyone likes, like Blake Shelton. Who cares about him? Kudos to you, LA. Kudos to you.
I wish I could give kudos to the local government for doing like the basic necessities first before giving Maz his own day. But whatever.
Art is a basic necessity.
More importantly than whatever John is about to say or has just said, the thing that I'm talking about is referred to as bunting. Bunting are pleated fans.
You mean like those like pinwheel things?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Okay. So if it is Adam White Day in the city of Grand Rapids, Michigan, I want to go on a podium that has one of those fuckers on the front of it, and that's where I give my speech and I get my key.
Adam, you know, I just had a great idea. Next Punk News event we do, we're going to give the key to the city to somebody, even though we have no authority to do so.
No authority. Yeah, we should do that all the time.
Let's wrap up this segment. Listen, speaking of great cities and soirees, it was the Punk New Summer Soiree this summer, and Posers was the band that played before World Inferno French Society. Posers, a band from Philadelphia. I love Posers. They've put out 2 7-inches and 2 7-inches only, as I've said many times before, kind of a cross between Avengers and Generation X. Adam, what, you saw them live. Did you enjoy Posers live, Adam?
Posers was super fun live. I had not experienced them too much on record prior to that show, but they were fun. They dressed for the occasion. They came to Soiree, which was great, and the crowd was super into them as far as I could tell. Like they were going off. It was great.
Well, it's all for naught because they're breaking up, which is a real shame. The band's broken up by now, and I'm not like losing sleep over it, but I am bummed out that Posers is breaking up. I think they had one of these common scenarios that you see is they put out 2 7-inches. Both 7-inches were great, but it was a long time. I mean, they've been a band for almost 4 years, I think, and they've only recorded like 9 songs or 8 songs. I think, especially in the modern era, you kind of have to get a quicker jump on things because you kind of have to see the fruits of your labor in order to get the energy to keep going, because there's no money in punk rock, as we all know. So I kind of think you need to put out an album maybe within 2 years and really, you know, get that feedback if you're going to make it or not. So I'm just sad. This is a great band. You should check them out. But what else can we say except for kudos to the Posers, and they were a great band.
Posers were cool.
This was a John band, so I didn't listen to them too often. So it sucks when this kind of stuff happens.
Yeah, it's a great band with great promise, and like definitely one of my favorite modern bands. And now they're broken up. And I'm running out of new bands to be a fan of. All I got now is Crazy in the Brains and Duchess Says.
Duchess Says is so great, John. All right, let's jump to another song here. I am so thrilled that we didn't actually spend all that much time talking about this brand new sexual misconduct thing, because
what is there to say? He's creepy.
What is there to say, man? You are up shit's creek, man. I don't know. I mean, there is no commentary that we can add to that one. It's like the biggest story in the universe as far as music goes right now. But, God, what the fuck do you do?
I'll tell you what you don't do, Adam. You don't try to make it with underage girls. It's not that hard. If you're famous, just get 18-year-old girls, and you're set. That are consenting, of course. It's not that hard. It's not that hard. Ask Tommy Lee.
I don't know. Ask Tommy Lee is now the role model for the kids, because
that's how far American society has sunk. Tommy Lee's a role model.
Holy God. All right. So we're playing songs from the venerable year of 1977. So here is another one. All this stuff bears no introduction at all. But I'm going to play you something from X-Ray Specs. This is a band where, I don't know, people know X-Ray Specs, John. I don't know why I'm even trying to introduce these things. Polystyrene, the lead singer of X-Ray Specs, was probably one of the most distinctive personalities that had come out of that early punk era. One of the earliest female punk vocalists, one of the earliest female punk vocalists of color. She didn't look anything like what anyone expected a rock star or a band leader to work like. And the stuff that her band played was aggressive and crazy and just, I don't know, super fun. So here you go. This is X-Ray Specs. They had, in 1977, a single that came out. On one side of that single was the song "Oh Bondage Up Yours." On the other side of that single was "I Am a Cliche." I haven't really figured out which of those I'm going to play right now, but I may as well just go with the obvious one. So here you go. X-Ray Specs with their absolute classic "Oh Bondage Up Yours" from 1977.
Some people think little girls should be seen and not heard, but I think, oh, bondage up yours! 1, 2, 3, 4! Yeah!
and that was X-Ray Specs doing "Oh Bondage Up Yours." There's an X-Ray Specs compilation called "Submission," I believe it's called, and it's got literally everything I ever recorded. It's got a radio session. It's got the whole album. It's got all the singles. If you do not have the X-Ray Specs album or the X-Ray Specs Greatest Hits CD compilation, you need "Germ Free Adolescence" is the album. You need to run out and buy that album. I mean, that is a crucial album. Adam White, crucial.
Oh man, I mean, that is among those records that you say you should have a copy of, like, you know, "Cut" by the Slits. You know, you should have, yes, a copy of Wire's "Pink Flag." You should have a copy of "Germ Free Adolescence." It's just one of those early punk classic things that you need to get a copy of. You know, I was listening to earlier today, John, I was listening to "Crossing the Red Sea" by the Adverts.
Ah.
And man, there are some bangers on there. The last song on that record, which sadly didn't come out in 1977, so I can't play it on this, "Great British Mistake." Oh God, that's one of my favorite songs. Anyways,
I would say the first, well, the first Adverts record, the whole thing is a banger straight through. The second one's cool too. But listen, let's get to the stuff that's most relevant to punk rock. Warped Tour. It's going to end in 2018. People were greatly shocked by this. Warped Tour has, of course, been a tour of new, notable, and some veteran punk bands for the past 25 years. No Doubt, Sublime, and bands like that kind of got their start, or not their start, but their first L7, No Use for a Name. Even Quicksand kind of got their first, I guess, wider exposure on Warped Tour. Since then, people have had different, you know, takes on it. In the late 90s, it was actually in the late 90s, Warped Tour was kind of punknews.org central, or at least that set in that Less Than Jake, Dropkick Murphys, Brouncing Souls, Rancid, Flogging Molly, Anti-Flag, The Offspring. I mean, that was mainstream 90s punk in a nutshell. After that, it kind of changed its identity, and it was kind of more of a emo and screamo kind of thing. My Chemical Romance, Avenged Sevenfold, Fall Out Boy, and even some pop acts like Black Eyed Peas, Katy Perry, and some crabcore bands, if you will. I forget the name of those bands. That's what they're called, crabcore. I didn't invent that.
I know. I haven't heard that uttered by a human being in like 4 years.
Crabcore. It was all the rage for a little while. Anyways, Warped Tour's ending. Kevin Lyman released a long statement, which you can read at punknews.org. He basically just said that he was happy and sad that it was ending. He didn't say why it was ending. A lot of people have a lot of different theories. This past year, Warped Tour did a semi-radical change in their positioning, in that they had the crabcore bands and those kind of bands, but they also had some old school punkers like the Dickies, but also they had on some political punkers like War on Women and those kinds of bands. So it was a real mix of bands, and it seemed to be an attempt of Warped Tour to change it up. Well, it didn't change it up enough, and it looks like the tour will be ending next year. A lot of people are upset. A lot of people are sad. A lot of people are glad to see it go. I think you can fairly say it's the end of an era if the era didn't end 10 years ago.
Yeah. You know, I was looking through the Facebook comments on the story. They were brutal. I think more people, just from people that are commenting, it was like 70-30 that they were happy it was ending. I'm just wondering, like, I've actually never been to a Warped Tour, so I'm thinking, and should I keep it pure, or should I just go for the last, should I think about going for the last one, just for like the meme or the joke or whatever. The other thing is, does this mean that Kevin Lyman is just done altogether? Because I really like It's Not Dead Fest, and I was hoping that would stay a thing. So I mean, that's my only question.
If I recall, Lyman is like Southern California local, right?
Yeah,
like, is he an LA guy, yeah. Right. I mean, he's got all the connections. For him to pull together a show is a lot easier for anyone else to pull together a show. So I imagine that you'll probably still have things like It's Not Dead and all that being put on, and he'll do more regional stuff. If I had to guess, that would be what he would do. So you're probably safe there. I mean, Warped Tour is a logistical fucking nightmare to put together. And
yeah.
I mean, despite any of its numerous faults, which we will enumerate in a second, you know, that is not an easy bit of cat herding to do for 25 years. So there's not at all. Some credit where it's due. That's pretty amazing. I can't think of any music event at that scale that's gone on for that long. it just, it, you know, you have music festivals that come back sort of year after year, but those are, you know, those are weekend events or whatever. Like this is a, this was an event in every town. It was a traveling thing. Yeah. So, you know, that's pretty amazing.
Go ahead. Oh yeah. So I just want to say, I mean, I interviewed him. He kind of let on that it was kind of a logistical nightmare. When I interviewed him for It's Not Dead, in the summer. The other thing is, I just wanted to share this because Riot Fest had a great tweet about this. They said, does this mean in 10 years Warped Tour will reunite with the original lineup and headline Riot Fest? And then Vans Warped Tour responded, how would that even work? So there was that. So yeah, that's all I wanted to throw
in. I mean, so let's not all be, I mean, I'll talk about my personal Warped Tour history in a minute, but the... You can't get out of the era that we're in, which is we're all trying to be aware of where the collective machinations that we've put together have really fucked over a lot of people. And, you know, Warped Tour is definitely not immune to that criticism. And there's been a handful of like screeds that I've read on Twitter today. From various people, some valid points that they're making, where they're saying like, yeah, like Warped Tour, you can't just go like, oh, Warped Tour is going away. Everything was magical when we had Warped Tour, because they're like, well, what about all like the abusers and things that they've had on that? And they went and they like made a list, and the list was sort of amazing in how deep it went, where there were basically, you know, I mean, like, John, your buddy Ronnie Radke at the top of it, but like but like just going through
Ronnie,
like,
what band is with Ronnie Radke in, what, which
Falling in Reverse, right? Yeah. just going through the list of bands that I mean, and the interesting thing to me is like bands that were almost exclusively from like the, let's say, like 2008 forward period, like this current crop of whatever you call, well, like whatever emo became, that this kind of like hair metal-y, at least in look, I don't know what you call it, like what, all these bands, is it Crabcore, John, is that what we're calling it? Like but just like they went through like all the people that were in all these bands that had been accused of some malfeasance against another human being, and in most cases young people of the opposite sex, and how many of them like were not just like had been accused of these things at some point in their existence, but had been accused of it in direct connection with them being on the Warped Tour. And it, you know, there's a pretty sordid history of that to dig through. So I don't want to completely come at this from a nostalgia standpoint. Like, you know, at any point when you're going to run a big event where you're going to bring in, you know, all these rock and roll bros and have them, you know, have them travel the country and, you know, play to young girls everywhere, you're gonna get all kinds of skeezy shit that comes out of the mix, and there's definitely a share of that. So I mean, I don't want to completely dwell on that because I don't have any firsthand you know, accounting or even secondhand accounting of any of it to really mention, but you know, go look it up if you want. Like there's definitely like a people's history of the Warped Tour out there that you can go read that is the less fun version of this.
I've got a little bit of a counterpoint to that, in that, you know, were people creepy and skeezy on Warped Tour? Sure. But Warped Tour is 25 years old. Anytime you get tens of thousands of people together, someone's going to act skeezy and sleazy and sneaky. And I think people are hammering Kevin Lyman and Warped Tour, not because they really feel as though Kevin Lyman is a bad guy, but just because they're trying to, you know, pump themselves up and say, look at me, aren't I such a good, holy person? Because I'm pointing out that what you think is cool is actually bad and insidious. I don't think Warped Tour is bad and insidious. Not my kind of music, generally speaking. But I think any group event, I would say Warped Tour is as skeezy or less skeezy. And I do think Kevin Lyman, and I'm not like a Kevin Lyman defend or anything. And I think he did the best he could under the circumstances, and I think Warped Tour was generally reasonable with regards to bad things that happened. And you can't – we're kind of entering an era where people want to be protected at all costs at any time, but that's just not how the world works, and that's not how the world works when you get a lot of people together. Is it wrong for people to get sexually assaulted or assaulted or however? Yes. Should the bad people be punished? And is it wrong for the bad people to do those bad things? Absolutely. But is it responsible for a person throwing an event to be responsible for every single little person, every single little event on the tour? No. Can a person possibly do that? No. So hammering Kevin Lyman for something like that is irresponsible and I would say somewhat gruesome, because you're using a very real and unfortunate which were not tragedy, but a negative aspect of the world, and you're using that to kind of be vengeful and exact blood for yourself, when really actual people have been hurt and are being hurt, and you're using that for your own purposes rather than to make things better for those kinds of people or those situations. And I don't think Warped Tour is in any way responsible or even encouraged or enabled that kind of bad behavior. To the opposite, I think Warped Tour did a admirable job in trying to stop and correct that behavior. You're never going to get it 100%, but Warped Tour, I think, did a pretty good job. So I think it's just sick for people to attack Warped Tour on that angle.
I just want to duly note that counter narrative has cropped up today and is out there. So, you know, if that's it's there to go read up about. Now, it doesn't, I mean, as Mr. Privilege here, like, it never, none of these negative things ever encountered, you know, I never encountered any of them, because, you know, I'm a straight white male, so I'm like fucking king of the world, right? So none of it affected me. But just like that discussion is happening, should you, the Punk News Podcast listener, want to go find someone that has like more firsthand knowledge of it than us. So just acknowledging that it's there. Now, getting on like the super nostalgia train. So Ricky, you've never been to a Warped Tour ever, which I'm amazed with.
Well, can I tell you why? Just real quick.
Yeah.
It was just because I was too young to go when the bands I would have wanted to see were there. And then when it got to be, when I was old enough to go, it was just like Falling in Reverse and all those kinds of bands. I didn't like them. So I just missed it. I was in that small group of, that small, like, I guess, generation or whatever, that just kind of missed the boat on the bands that I would have wanted to see.
You were born too late, Ricky.
I was, what was it? When did it start? 95 or 6?
97, I want to say.
I was 5.
You were 5. God.
Yeah.
All right. So, So my first Warped Tour, and this was really early in my getting into bands in general, would have been the 1999 Vans Warped Tour, and my venue was always to go to Buffalo, and at that point it was at a place called LaSalle Park that was in Buffalo. So 99 was the first one. The whole reason why I went to that tour at all would have been because Less Than Jake was playing it, and I was like a giant Less Than Jake fan, and just a few weeks before that tour, before the tour actually came to Buffalo, was when Blink-182's Enema of the State came out. And when that record came out, it wasn't immediately big. Like, it got big when All the Small Things, the video for that, parodied all of those boy band things that were happening, because that got a lot of MTV play and that really boosted it. But when that record initially came out, like, it wasn't like a mega release or anything like that. It wasn't as big as it ended up getting. So we were into that too. So I went to that tour. Less Than Jake was there. Blink-182 was there. The Dropkick Murphys, the Bouncing Souls, the Living End from Australia, which was cool to see, H2O. So that was all great. I'm looking at the lineup now on some website that's compiling the old lineups, and it's hilarious to me who is at that show. So Eminem was there. I don't remember that at all, but he was there. Ice-T was there. I think I kind of remember that.
Was he there, or was he there as body count, though?
No, like, he was there as Ice-T. Mm. And And the one that I do remember and is so fucking surreal to me is Black Eyed Peas were there. And this was Black Eyed Peas before that band broke big. And this was before they had Fergie in the band. So Black Eyed Peas at that point, if I recall, was just considered one of these like they were like an alternative hip hop act at the time. And like the, and they were and the stage that they played was this is a while back, but like if I recall, super tiny and no one really gave a shit amongst all the punk rockers that were there, but they played it. And so that's just super super weird to me to think about like how big and obnoxious that band got compared to them being there. So 99 was the first one that I had ever done. And I went to them pretty religiously, 99, 2000, 2001, 2002, all in Buffalo. 2003, I went to the one in Toronto, but it wasn't in Toronto. It was in a city called Barrie, which is like 2 hours north of Toronto, but it was technically the Toronto stop. And then that was the last one that I actually have any kind of ticket stub for. So as far as I understand, that 2003 was the last one that I would have like paid money to go to. I know for sure that I was at the one in Barrie again on 2006. I'm going to name drop a whole bunch of stuff when I talk about this, but 2006, I definitely went to one of them. And so I probably weaseled my way into that one as like, hi, I'm Adam from Punk News. I want to pass to this. But as far as I can tell, that was it. The one that was at in Barrie in 2006, which was the last one I ever went to. I've told this story before and it's totally, I'm sorry to everyone, but there was a point where we were sitting around backstage at a picnic table and it was like me and Aubin from Punk News and, Tim McReliff or whatever his name is from Rise Against. And I think like Chris number two from Anti-Flag, and we're all sitting at a picnic table as Against Me plays on the stage that is adjacent to us. And we're all sitting around talking about how no one seems to be all that into searching for a former clarity. But then they're on stage and they play The Ocean. And then one of them, I forget if it was Chris or Tim, comments that like God, they should write more stuff like this. Because this song is just like, it's so, it feels so deep and so heartfelt compared to some of the stuff that's on Clarity. And we're all nodding in agreement. Like, yeah, man, like this song is it. And it's crazy how much
that really is crazy.
Like how much The Ocean has sort of become like that was the precursor that everyone was able to notice to everything that became, you know, the Tom Gable to Laura Jane Grace thing, all the history of the band that happened since then. Like you can see Laura expressing all of those feelings in The Ocean, like super vocally. And like there's stuff on Against Me records before that of course, you know, we're hinting at some of the trans the gender dysphoria, but like nothing as explicit as that. And it was crazy just hearing these people from other bands being like, yeah, like we like the new material, but like holy fuck, The Ocean is next level and we're not sure why. And it's like, well, that's why. So that was nuts when I think about that. But yeah, I don't know, like there was a lot of years that I went to Warped Tours regularly in those late 90s, early 2000s eras, where I saw a lot of bands that helped, you know, helped inform who I was. And I'm sitting here looking at lists of who played some of these things, and it's probably super boring for anyone to listen to me just like enumerate bands, but like
What year was that?
That one would have been 2006 for sure. Because I remember specifically.
Really?
I remember because Joan Jett played that show as well, along with Hum. And like Hum was pretty fucking loud. But like Joan Jett played that show as well. And I forget if Laura went out with Joan and played with them, or if like, or if she was just like pumping up that like you should totally go see Joan Jett and the Blackhearts. But like it was cool. Let's see.
It's interesting that Against Me played The Ocean, because New Wave didn't come out till the next year.
No, that's the thing. Like they were playing it, and yeah, that makes sense actually. Sorry, they were playing that song. Like they were doing it. So everyone we had all heard Searching for a Form of Clarity, because that was out at that point. But everyone's opinion of that was sort of like iffy, because that was the one that was Clarity is a lot of songs like about the music industry and things like that. But they were playing The Ocean live prior to it actually being out on that record, and just like you could just like sit there and listen, like that was probably the first time I ever heard it, was live on stage, and like you could hear it, and you're like, holy shit, like this song is heartfelt, like this is not, you know, singing about like, you know, get your manager to call my manager or whatever, right? Like this shit is next level. So it was nuts having that. You know what? That was also the show. Big punk news moment. Pretty sure NoFX played that date. That's the date where NoFX were on stage. Mike sang "Punk News It's Much Orgier in Canada" during the song "The Heroin Is Much Better in Canada." So there you go. That's all my name dropping that I've all put it out there. But like going back to like before I was fucking cool. Like Warped Tour 2000s, I'm looking at the lineup of. Green Day, that was probably the only time I've ever seen Green Day. Like they played that show. Long Beach Dub All Stars, I remember seeing playing that. And I mean I was a ska kid, so that was the closest I was gonna get to seeing Sublime. So they were there. Who else? I remember seeing Small Brown Bike for the first time that year, and I thought that was actually pretty cool. Flogging Molly were there, early Hot Water Music. So yeah, there was a lot. I mean, the early Warped Tours were very important to my like musical development, and exposed me to a lot of bands that I wouldn't have been able to go see otherwise, or at least otherwise on the budget that I was on. So I totally appreciate that. That I got that out of it. All the negativity surrounding the tour since I can't personally speak to. So all of that, like all that, you know, scumbaggy stuff that I mentioned earlier, like I have no experience with. All of these horrible crabcore bands or whatever, like I never encountered any of them, you know, outside of writing about it on Punk News. So I can't really speak to that either. So I have really rose colored glasses about my years with the Warped Tour, but you know, it was a thing. It's not anymore. John, did you ever do it? Did you ever take the plunge?
I did go one year, and actually I got there through a publication. So I was hanging out backstage, or not backstage, you know, like in like the, well, I call it the, what do you call it? The picnic bench section, you know, the picnic table thing. And I'm sitting there with a blonde guy and a blonde girl. And I'm like, you know, your guys' bands are really good. They're like, well, you should come play with us. I'm like, all right, sure. So anyways, the blonde gets up on stage and they're doing Santeria. And they're like, and John Gentile, everybody. So I get up there, I'm playing bass. And Gwen Stefani comes out and she starts singing a Bad Brains cover. So there I am playing bass with Sublime. Gwen Stefani.
Yeah. Okay.
No, I've never been to Warped Tour, but what I have been to is the Screaming Females live show, which is an amazing show. And we're not going to talk about Screaming Females every week on the podcast, but I do feel as though they're an important band, and I do feel as though we should cover them because they are an important and unique band, and they're releasing a new album. And I want to be on record. You know, there's a famous quote with Led Zeppelin, you know, that band is going to go down like a Led Zeppelin. Everybody laughs at that guy for the next 60 years. I don't want to be that guy. I want to be the guy that says this band is cool, and 60 years later, everyone's like, damn, that was the best band ever. Screaming Females, they've released a new single. The new single is called Deeply, and it's off the new album. The new album is called All at Once. It's going to be a double LP. They released a couple of track so far. The tracks have been kind of mid-tempo, very, what I would say, a lot of tone to them, a lot of texture to them. Not the, in contrast to the last album, which was Rose Mountain, which were hard chargers. This album seems to be kind of the mid-tempo, reflective, thoughtful one. And I thought this track was incredible. I think this is going to be their Zen Arcade. And I'm not even a fan of Zen Arcade, but I think this is going to be their Zen Arcade. And an amazing, deep, multifaceted, multi-textured album. And this track rocked. Not actually, it didn't rock. It moved me.
My reaction to this is the same as the other Screaming Females stuff that we've heard in the lead up to this record, which is like, I can get down with it, but I'm not feeling the hook. And that's just, it's making me want to stop listening to the pre-release stuff and just do this record as the record. Because I think I'm going to appreciate it way more as I mean, they've told us, I mean, specifically us, they've told us how, what they wanted to do with this, where they were going to go in and, like, you know, do everything, right? Like any weird idea that they've got, they're going to put on this record. It's, you know, Rose Mountain is going to be like a pretty tightly wound pop record compared to this one. And this one, they're just going to like let it all out, right? Knowing that, I don't want to listen to this as singles. Like, I want to really get into it as a single piece.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be a singles album at all. I think it's going to be an album, you know.
Yeah. So I'm looking forward to it, but it feels like it's taking forever. It's got to hurry up, John.
They gave it like 5 months, like, you know, records now you kind of get like 2 months notice. This is a 5 month notice record. That's a long time.
This, you know what? I know you guys like this band. I think they're okay. I never really got into them. This didn't do much for me. I got nothing against them. I mean, if they're good for everyone else, it's great.
Burn in hell, Ricky.
Go to hell.
I was going to say,
go ahead, Ricky. What's that?
I mean, of the lyric videos that I've seen lately, this was a better one.
It's almost like not even a lyric video. It's like, why even do the lyric? Why not just do something on camera? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know. The lyric video thing is a strange phenomenon, except for some very rare cases. But I tried it again, guys. I always, you know.
Listen, maybe when Ricky gets of age, he'll be able to appreciate mature things like Screaming Females.
I'm 25.
Let's talk about the exact opposite of Screaming Females. In contrast to mature, textured, and thoughtful approach, Mean Jeans have released another beverage theme song. Their first beverage theme song was a Mountain Dew theme song, which actually got them some sort of contract with Mountain Dew. They posted just the headline of the contract online and a whole bunch of Mountain Dew. So Mean Jeans' Mountain Dew song actually did get them a contract with Mountain Dew in some respects. Following on the success of that, they've released a Coors Light song. It's called "You're the Light of My Life," Coors Light. This song, whereas the Mountain Dew song was kind of totally complimentary of Mountain Dew, this Coors Light song is a little bit edgier. They talk about how they don't want to be sober, and it's got a little bit of a darker and, I guess, kind of just sketchier angle. So I don't know if this is going to get them a Coors Light contract or not, but I thought it was hilarious. And I thought what is amazing about this is, even when writing joke songs, Mean Jeans just have a phenomenal ear for crafting solid songs. Maybe just because they're ripping off the Ramones, but it's great.
I don't know if they definitely are Ramones in the Ramones core family. I don't know if they're ripping off the Ramones, especially if you listen to their last album, Tight New Dimension. But what I'm kind of hoping they do is either they continue doing this singles theme and make some sort of like one-time pressing of a collection of these kinds of songs, or they put like this song and the Mountain Dew song on like a 7-inch for a limited press. I hope they do something more with this. I hope they continue doing this. I think this is a really fun idea.
I was critical of the Mountain Dew song when we played it because I said it didn't go far enough into absurdity for my tastes, and that it was a little bit too close to being just a straight homage to a beverage and not not something weird. But I'm changing my tune on that analysis, given that they've done this other one. And I think as a body of work, you know, one song about a beverage that you really like played straight is a little curious, but two is art. I don't know why that is, but having that song and this song exist together in the same universe either says that, you know, at the very least, like Ricky said, they've got a pretty weird 7-inch that they can release.
Yeah.
But if it's more than that, it's something dumb, but like gloriously dumb, and I'm game. So
yeah, I mean, if they kept like releasing these every once in a while, getting sponsored or not, and then like at the end, like maybe halfway through, like next year, they put something out, like a record of just a collection of these, I think that'd be really stupid and. But in a really fun way, yeah. You know?
You could take it any number of ways that would all be sort of fun. You know, you could have a record that's got like 10 different songs about beverages all played straight, and that just in and of itself is weird. You could have a record that's got a bunch of songs about various products and then say like one song about murder. And when you put it all together, it in fact is pretty bizarre. If you're say Mountain Dew and looking at that collection and going like, oh shit,
they should just try and get it sponsored as many sponsorships
or
as possible.
Or if the goal is shit, let's cash in and get as many sponsorships as possible aggressively, right? Then the act of doing that in public is almost in and of itself like a performance art piece. So whatever direction they're going with this, I'm down, whatever. I'm in for the journey.
I also wonder if like if that contract that they posted was like, we want to use this for our next commercial or something like that.
Honestly, I wouldn't know. My guess is Mountain Dew thought what they were doing was funny. So they were like, all right, here's a grand. We're going to retain exclusive rights on your song, and maybe we'll use it on an online video or something. So they're actually kind of just getting advertising through Mean Jeans. And Mean Jeans is like, look what we got. You know what I mean? So because the song I think was a little too edgy for mainstream commercial. But then again, mainstream commercials are edgier than ever. So maybe. But then again, it wasn't necessarily complimentary. Like Mountain Dew, I need it. I don't know. Anyways, let's wrap this up. We're going to play one more song and come back. This might not be real original or real thoughtful, but we're just going to play 1977 by The Clash because it's 1977. We got punk news and it's The Clash. So this is 1977 by The Clash. You've all heard it before. You're going to hear it again. And that was 1977 by The Clash, the B-side off White Riot, I believe. Or is it London's Bird? I think it's White Riot, the B-side in 1977. Flip that around, A-side. Anyways, boys, we covered it all. We covered Sexual Assault. We covered the end of Warped Tour. We covered Morrissey Day in L.A. What a big week it was here at Punk News. We covered it all.
It did get a little, it was a pretty spicy week, whichever way you look at it.
I feel that we're definitely letting it show here that we in the first place didn't give a lot of shit about Brand New, because I'm totally convinced, almost self-consciously so, that there are other, you know, there are people right now that are writing novels, that are recording hours of podcast audio or whatever, you know, just wringing their hands about what to do about this Brand New issue, because I cannot understate how much that band matters to some people. I can also not understate how little we at the Punk News Podcast gave a shit before there was a controversy.
Yeah.
So it's an odd thing to, you know, we're going to breeze over it so we can talk about the Warped Tour, because yeah. So just, you know, I just want to keep acknowledging that to some people, this is like, this is the fucking Watergate scandal. Like, this is the biggest thing that could possibly happen in the news ever, but not for us.
This has been a Valor Underground production. I am Greg Simpson, producer of this podcast. Hit me up if you want me to mix, master, or produce your podcast, even from afar. Or you got a band you want to come record with me in scenic Lafayette, Indiana? Let's do it. Hit me up at Greg@ValorUndergroundStudios.com.